Welcome to the Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour, maybe even more, on this July the 16th on the West Coast, now July the 17th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone, and certainly in the time zone in Argentina. We have a wonderful guest with us tonight. I'm sure you're all chomping at the bit to hear what he has to say, and I'll be bringing him on in a moment. Want to acknowledge all those folks listening in around the world on Wind Talkers Radio Network, especially those of you in the U.S. military, and also on blogtalkradio.com. Well, we got the news today that this well from hell, as tonight's guest calls it, has been capped. So we have the first half of cap and trade. I guess now the trade-off has to take place. Let's be cautious. We've seen blue water while the thing was leaking millions of gallons of oil. And after they put the cap on it, the water turned black again with the same light. You figure it out. Tonight's guest I referred to him on my schedule, on the Evident Footprint schedule, as a researcher, a producer of documentary films, but he is an international economist. He is quite outspoken about geopolitical matters, and he is the founder of the movement for the Second Republic of Argentina, and looking forward to very much to this interview and one that we're going to have again next week with scientist inventor Jim Murray. I'd like to welcome to the show for the first time Mr. Adrian Salvucci.
Good evening, Don. How are you? Great speaking to you and having the chance to talk to address myself to your audience.
Well, it's a pleasure. Now, I have to apologize because you are a man of many hats, and I haven't seen you wearing a New York Yankees hat. I hope you don't, actually.
Although I was brought up in New York, I must say, but I wasn't a Yankees fan.
Well, I have been a Cleveland Indians fan. It just, you have to root for somebody, you know.
I can relate to that. Yeah,
root for the underdog. Of course, I'm just kidding. But you do quite a number of things, and in your background, your professional background is very impressive. I wonder if you would share that with the listeners so they have a feel for your experience and your knowledge and the things that you've worked on.
Well, basically, Don, and I thank you very much for that very generous introduction that you've just made. But what I try and pride myself in doing is using just simple common sense to reach the logical conclusion about many things, in spite of all that we watch on CNN and Fox Television and we read about in the New York Times and the Washington Post and so forth. Basically, what I've done, I come from my professional, so to speak, area is risk management. I've been in insurance, reinsurance, and risk management for many, many years, which gives you a very interesting and global vision, especially the reinsurance side and especially the risk management side. Mm-hmm. I mean, risk management should be the first thing anybody does before you go on to strategic planning. The first thing you want to know is what risks are out there, why are they out there, and what should I be doing about it? If even more, can I do anything about them? And then you find that there are certain risks or perils or dangers that you can't do anything about, so you might as well learn to live with them. And there are others that you can definitely minimize, mitigate, and even get rid of. That being said, I use that with that's just on my professional side. I use that with the fact that having been born and lived most of my adult life, for the last 30 years at least, in Argentina has been a country, and it still is, which has gone through much, much turmoil politically, economically, financially. As time goes on, as the decades go by, actually, you start to build up certain experience and you start to understand, well, you know, hang on here, what is happening? I'll just give you an example. I'm going to be turning 58 years old in a couple of weeks' time, and yet I've gone in my adult life through three really, really severe financial and economic meltdowns. In 1975, in 1989, we had hyperinflation. I think it's the fourth worst hyperinflation in the history of the world. And then in 2001, 2002, we went through a systemic banking, financial, and monetary collapse, which threw the country into turmoil. It reduced gross domestic product by about 40%, and it sent 50% of our population below the poverty line. So when you go through these things, you start sort of scratching your head and saying, hey, what's going on here? And that's to sort of wrap up the idea. That's when I started, or I've been studying how these power structures, these global power structures work in the world. I was very concerned, what do they want out of Argentina? I think I started to understand what they want from this country, from this whole part of the world. And you start putting two and two, and it just equals four. And it's just a question of using common sense. And you start to understand that behind all this turmoil, behind all the confusion and the buzzing and so forth that you see on the television and you read about in the papers, there's a model behind this. There is a certain logic. And when you understand the reasons and the logic behind the machine or a model, then you can understand how the whole thing works.
Mm-hmm. And you don't necessarily have to agree with the reasons or the model. It's just understanding what it is.
Well, yeah. The first thing, I mean, if you feel that something presents a danger to you, well, you have to know, okay, what are the rules of that danger? Even crossing the street is a model in a way. There is a danger in crossing the street, but if you know from beforehand that all the people coming from the left are going to be driving on the right, and all the people coming from the right from the right side are going to be driving on the other side of the road, well, then you have an idea as you cross which way to look. It can be something as simple as that, or it can be something much more complex, like trying to understand why do we have periodic financial breakdowns.
Mm-hmm. And why are the same people always seem to be in the background involved in those?
Well, yeah, but you know, that's a very good point. If you look at it, the whole global system, at least in the Western world, which is what is closest to us, you know, America, the United States for you, Argentina for me, and so forth, you start to realize that there is a small group of people who are bent on re-engineering the entire planet. And they've been doing this for decades, probably for centuries. And one of the first conclusions that you reach is, okay, they need to have power. They need to wield power. Now, certain plans, you can pull them off in a year or 2 years, like in your own private life or in your company. Other plans are more complex. They need more time. And if you want to re-engineer the whole planet, you need a lot of time, which means that you cannot cope and you cannot accept the democratic system. You cannot have power, you know, be interrupted every 4 years. So what we have is that real power in the world has migrated towards private structures, which are not subject to the democratic process. So that's why you find that although presidents come and go and ministers come and go and prime ministers come and go, very often nobody even remembers them. And yet the real people who wield real power, like your Rockefellers, your Harrimans, your Rothschilds, your Warburgs, your Schiffs, your Buffetts, these guys, are your Brzezinskis, your Kissingers, they're around year after year, decade after decade, and they only cease having power normally when they die. And by that time, they've already left who their successor is going to be. I'm sure David Rockefeller has it very clear in his mind who's going to be the guy who's going to take up from him once he dies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you bring up a lot of good points. For the average person who doesn't do the research, they rely on hearing what's going on and getting their impressions from the media. And the media certainly doesn't tell us what's actually going on. That's what this show is about tonight. We're going to talk about the things that they don't talk about, or we can talk about what they talk about and why they give us the information they do, because it's all designed to lead us down a pathway, sort of like the stockyards in Chicago. Don't you find it kind of coincidental that the stockyards are in Chicago?
Yeah, the Windy City.
You know, and so we are educated and to accept certain things. I'm finding out from my research that we've been lied to about modern history. And on that basis, you can assume that we've been lied to about the history before the modern history, going back thousands of years. We've not been told the truth about science, and we've not been told the truth about where money comes from and why we worship gold more than we do platinum or silver. Or today, why we worship paper, you know, because that's really the reality. Now, what in other words, we have these two paradigms. We have the truth, which is being obfuscated. It's being hidden from us. And then we have this false reality, this illusion that they want us to believe is our lot in life. Do you want to comment on that from your perspective?
Well, yeah, absolutely, because I definitely agree with you on that. In a way, it's as though any individual, you, me, any of your listeners, if you were to have a big knock on your head and you have amnesia, and you figure, God, it must be terrible. I can recognize things. I still know how to speak. I still know how to do things. But I can't remember who I am, and I can't remember anybody around me. So if you don't remember who you are and what you've been doing up to now, anybody can come around, and they can be telling you the truth. Hey, listen, like, you know, you don't remember me, but I'm your dad, or I'm your brother, or I'm your son. Or let me give you an example. Let's say that you happen to be very wealthy. Any SOB might come around and say, hey, you don't remember me, but I'm your buddy or I'm your brother, and you should be sharing this with me and so forth. And if you have amnesia, you will always be confused. You might say, hey, maybe this guy does want the best for me, or maybe this person is telling the truth. Well, the same thing happens with an entire nation. Mm-hmm. If you are lied about what your real history is all about, it's as though the entire country had amnesia. So you end up thinking that your friends are your enemies, and you might even think that one of your enemies might convince you to think that he's your friend. So a lot of mischief can come out of that. And, you know, it's a very crucial point. Mankind's experience is his real history. So in a way, I'm not saying we should all be historians, but we should have an idea that goes a bit beyond high school or grade school or high school history classes, and understand why, as you were saying, mankind has come to the point that he's come, where his scientific developments have arisen from, what the proper way of thinking is. I mean, you know, we used to think about, we used to be holistic thinkers in like a thousand or two or 3,000 years ago. Now we are just very a silo thinking mentality. We are great specialists at whatever your profession is, whether it be engineering or medicine or a lawyer or whatever. But then when you say, okay, let's go a little bit further afield, we are often absolutely ignorant. And that makes it very easy for certain devious people to put the wrong contents and the wrong information into the collective psyche. And you can see that definitely in the United States, and very definitely in Argentina, where the mass media, they seem to relish on permanently making us forget. In a way, it's giving us sort of, you know, collective engineered amnesia, so that people will not remember who they are. And when you have people who are practically a clean slate, just watching the television and not knowing where their whole country is coming from, where their whole civilization and culture is coming from, those are the easiest people to be misled. And I think it helps to explain why the world right now is the way it is.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'd like to just make a comment. When I first heard you speak, and it was via the internet, and I was watching some of your videos and reading some of your writings, some of your articles and your pieces on, which are really critiques on what's going on. But please don't be offended. My first impression was, this is a person who's saying many of the things I'm saying. Is this by chance, or is this by design?
Well, we share the same. You see, we share common sense, and different people, totally without even knowing each other, and to completely different parts of the world. If you have common sense, it's very likely that you will reach the same conclusions.
Yes, yes. Well, I kept tabs on your videos and your articles as much as I could, and I sort of fought this desire, this temptation to contact you. Because I wanted to be sure that your message, and I have to tell you that it was like the whole thing just opened up, like a book opened up, and I came to a self-realization that this person's message is their message. I consider myself a messenger, and I definitely consider you to be one. And we may not agree on everything. We're going to say what we feel and what we see based upon our experiences, upon our intimate knowledge of certain topics. And again, that isn't that experience. And I you know, the scale tipped over, or the teeter-totter, you know, completely made its complete revolution. And I said, I have to have this man on my show. I have to bring his message forth. So It's that caution, it's that discernment, and all of that that I recognize in myself, and I saw that in you as well. Many of the same truths came out in your speaking, and I thought, well, here's another person who has a message, and it's a distinct message. What motivated you to do the type of work you're doing is probably the same thing that motivated me to do mine. And well, and as a result, we can share that now and become something bigger.
Absolutely. In actual fact, I was listening to you very, very carefully, and yes, people having common values and a common, let's say, common sense, in the sense that as you grow older and as you know, experience goes by in your life, you tend to see things in their real perspective. Like, you know, you it's like an impressionist painting. If you get up too close to a painting by Renoir, all you see are little dots, green dots, red dots, yellow dots, blue dots. Because you're just too damn close. But as you move away, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 feet, you start seeing a beautiful picture, because they are meant to be seen taking a bit of perspective. So, which is the way, you know, which is, I think, what happens in life as we go along and as we try to understand all these very complex processes. However, what I think is very good, and we can all work together to bring something, to the table that will be much more than the mere sum of its parts, is the fact that each of us is living in a different country and a different experience, and we've gone through different things. Like, for example, what has happened to the United States starting in, I don't know, March or April 2008, when Bear Stearns went, and then in September when your financial crisis really blew up. I know that it's taken many, many people in the United States completely by surprise. It's generated enormous hardship. I was listening today on the television that last year there were something like 900,000 houses in foreclosure, and they estimate that for 2010 it'll be over 1 million houses. That's 1 million families whose homes are being foreclosed. And I can tell, oh, what confusion, what dramatic surprise. And yet, when I look at my own country, in a way we can say, well, we've been through that too many times. So in a way, we even tend to understand how the whole as I was saying before, how the whole mechanism works. And I think that sharing the experiences of what's happened in Argentina, what's happening happened in the United States, and then you see how certain things very similar happen in Europe. For example, I was telling you a little while back, in 1989 we underwent horrendous hyperinflation. You really have to live through it, because it's absolute chaos. We had something like 10,000% inflation in just 1 year, 1989. But then you look back in a bit further afield in history, and in 1923, the Germans went through something even worse with their hyperinflation, and it created such social turmoil, well, that we know how that whole thing ended up in Germany. And, you know, they that helped to bring a more extreme and radicalized regime into power. So very often seeing, you know, it's like George Santayana used to say, those who do not learn from history are condemned to relive it. I think it's good that we should learn from our own history. And history is not just reading the books, but or even reading the facts, because you can fill your head up with a lot of facts, like Abe Lincoln was born on such and such a date, and George Washington died on such other day, and the French Revolution was in such and such a year. It's not the actual data. It's the logic behind it, because what you have is the logic of how the collective psyche moves forward and how very, you know, it sort of lurches forward. It goes forwards and backwards sometimes. You know, like Lenin used to say, we go forward two steps or we go backward one step. We go forward two steps. So, you know, you sort of have this lurching movement. But no doubt about it that the more you learn from what's happening to your own people and to other nations, and not just today in 2010, but in 1910 and in 1950, and why not in 1610, well, you start seeing that perspective and you start to understand that there are certain things that are so complex that you cannot see them in one go. You might laugh at what I'm about to say. I don't buy newspapers. I haven't bought a newspaper, I think, something like 3 years, because newspapers are extremely, extremely, how should I say, they're really harmful, because they will give you little slices every day of information, a lot of data about very complex processes, but they will never give you the perspective to understand how the process works. You were just saying, what is money? Nobody will ever tell you what money is. However, they will fill you with data about, I don't know, rates of exchange, interest rates, all the information, all the number crunching referring to finance. But nobody will ever tell you what on earth is money, or what you were saying also a few minutes ago, which is very important. Why does the collective psyche perceive gold as having one type of value, and why doesn't it perceive other metals as having the same value, or having or taking the same, a similar attitude? And we can see it with this, all this flight to safety with a lot of people purchasing gold nowadays.
Yes. I don't mean to shock you, I haven't bought a newspaper in about 20 years.
Okay, you beat me. Very good.
And I couldn't, when I discovered that I couldn't train my puppy to use it as a litter box, you know, for emergencies. And
that's all they're good for, really.
Well, I couldn't even use it for that. I said it's worthless, you know.
Very good, very good, very good.
So, And I feel stronger about that today, because we're not getting the truth. Now, one thing I'd like to bring up, and you mentioned you mentioned 2008. Since late 2006, I have been telling people what's going on in the derivatives, hedge fund markets, and the banks, and the massive looting of the U.S. Treasury. By this cabal, which is a sort of a geopolitical cabal that kowtows to the Zionist banking cartel, we'll say,
right,
and the oil cartel and the pharmaceutical cartel, and whatever else they like to control. What they tell us about our relationships from country to country, I've determined are false. I lived in Switzerland, I lived in Germany, I lived in Italy, I traveled all over Europe and Africa and parts of Asia, and I can tell you that my experiences were pleasant. I met the people, I dealt with the people, I didn't deal with the governments.
That makes a difference.
It's a big difference, okay? So there's no problem getting along with people from other countries. I learned the languages of those countries as well. And I've been to many, many other countries. And again, my experiences were similar. Now, the average person out there hasn't done that. That's not to say that there aren't people who haven't traveled the world. You yourself have traveled the world, I'm quite sure. And so you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it doesn't matter what you're told by the media. That experience is irreplaceable. No one can tell you or dictate to you what that experience was like or what it should be like.
Right.
The experience itself reveals that. Now, what is going on internationally with the Basel II and the Basel III requirement to have a gold standard is the whole essence of the problem of the U.S. financial system, because we are not compliant with that. we have a bunch of thieves who have stolen the gold, and they're creating debt instruments, illusory paper money with their Masonic symbols and their secret society symbols on it to be the seal of their ritualistic practices, which are all evil, despite the fact that they want to make us be the evil ones because we are rising up against them in our speech, in our thoughts, and in our communications. But really, it boils down to whether or not you know that there is a God, there is a creator that has created the whole universe, and there are specific laws that allow it to operate very peacefully and very naturally. Doesn't mean there won't be problems, but people living and working and loving each other, they can certainly resolve problems. Killing people through war or the creation of war is not a means of arriving at peace. Anything you want to say in that regard?
Well, I couldn't agree more. And you very graciously mentioned at the beginning of the program in your introduction that we are trying to promote here. Well, we've been doing this for the last 15 years, what we call the Second Argentine Republic Movement, which, by the way, we are now suggesting. I'm also uploading some information material in English. We call it the Second Republic Project in English itself. Because after sharing a conference with G. Edward Griffin in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in March of this year, and with a couple of other friends, we agreed that we would try to promote this practically as a template that can be used by almost any country. And why do I say this? And it ties in with what you're saying. Because the problem that practically every country in the world is facing, Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, the UK, France, the United States, is that our countries have been taken away from us. The nation state, the sovereign nation state, which has to focus on promoting the common good for the majority of the people inside its borders and defending the national interest outside its borders because of all the things that are happening around each country and above each country, especially the globalist supranational structure. So the first thing that we have to do is recover that sovereign nation state. In other words, we have to, I'll say it as far as Argentina is concerned, what we're saying here is the Argentine state has eroded into a colonial administration. So we can't reform it. We can't fix it. We have to chuck it out the window. We have to throw it out and found a new republic with everything new in the sense that based on common sense, our whole legal system has become so poisoned, our political system so corrupt, our political elite so absolutely mediocre and money dependent that it's not a question of saying, well, we can fix it. No, you can't fix it. It's like when you have an old car, which is an old lemon, you got to throw it away and buy a new car. Mm-hmm. And Second Republic, the idea behind the Second Republic has five key pillars referring to recovering the sovereign state, recovering a sovereign currency and monetary and banking system, doing away with the debt rationale. It seems that we have to do everything by debt, and in the case of Argentina, we have a public debt which is above our gross domestic product, and it has completely squashed the country for the last 3 years. Naturally, we have to the fourth pillar will be recovering the Republican institutions, and the fifth one, which is the one I wanted to refer to specifically, is what we're saying is we have to put everything the world over the right side up. In other words, finance has to be subordinated and has to serve the real economy. The economy has to obey a political project. In other words, what emanates from a true political plan for the future, which will guarantee the happiness and the well-being, the welfare and the well-being of the people. The political system has to be subordinated to a country's culture. I always give a favorite example in the political system in Argentina has to allow people to kill cows because we like to have our barbecues. But the political system in India has to be subordinated to the culture of India, which says that cows are sacred, so they have to prohibit anybody killing cows. Why? Because the political system has to respect the culture of the local peoples. Argentinians eat barbecues. The Indians don't ever do that. They respect cows. Cows are sacred. And the cultural system, and this is the very key point, has to be subordinated to God or the transcendental or Jesus or call it whatever you like, Buddha. I'm not going to argue about the name, but it is that intuition that we should all have, and I think we all do have one way or another, that only when you have an intuition of something which is far above the merely material, the merely human everyday life, that there is a cosmic law and order and that there is a cosmic truth, only that will give true significance for all human actions, whether they be individual or collective. Why is the New World Order so everything is so bad for every country? Because it's what I just said, but completely upside down. Finance has totally destroyed the economy. The economy pays for the politics. Politics destroys culture. And when you destroy culture, you have no need for God or for anything transcendental.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Very well said. And I'm glad you said what you said, because we are witnessing the dichotomy of the creation. Everything in this system, this geopolitical system that is being shoved down everyone's throat, is based on destruction.
Yeah.
Ill health, whether it's ill health, mind control, dumbing down through what they like to call education, you know, and yeah. even the lies about the true nature of the universe and the lies about God. This new political system, if a political system is required, would have to adhere to universal law, wouldn't you agree?
Well, absolutely, and if you look at it, the physical universe will show you that a good part of it, maybe all of it, is governed by entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, which says that all systems tend to become more chaotic. However, the mystery of life, which is where I think God really comes into this whole thing, is absolutely negentropic. I mean, think of it. Think of all the physical attack on your body and my body and our listeners' bodies that life has to overcome, because we have too much heat, too much cold, things break down, chemical reactions and everything. Everything which tends to bring the body and dissolve it. And yet there is an inherent intelligence in all living beings, whether they be men, animals, plants or whatever, which is negentropic. It goes against that tendency towards chaos, and it brings order back into this thing. Now, that is in the, let's say, in the world of physics. However, in the world of politics, we have exactly, I think, the same process. And it's a guideline to what I think people like yourself and myself are actually doing. In a world where the powers that be seem to try to promote all chaos, all entropy, we are negentropic. We try to bring back and say, listen, if you just calm down a little bit, put some good music, maybe Bach, maybe Beethoven, you will have this intuition that there is an order in the universe, and all that us frail human beings have to do is align our thoughts, our feelings, and then our behavior to those laws. We don't have to invent anything. Actually, there's no need to invent anything. It's just a question of, you know, not reading the papers, turning off the television set, and listening to, I don't know, the wind in the treetops, and you will see that there's more lessons there than what you can read in all these newspapers and books and everything that very often are plugged down our thoughts, our throats, as though that was the revealed truth of, and these people have very good reason for wanting to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I so much agree with what you're saying, and it brings up, you know, so many other thoughts in my mind that we could discuss. Just to use your word, entropy, in the sense that you are using it, couldn't you also say that this system is causing us to spin our wheels? In other words, the thermodynamic quantity that is not producing work or accomplishing any growth, positive, uplifting growth in the consciousness of mankind, is by design.
This, yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, just as you were saying, I was thinking, it's like the concept of interest. I got very, very hung up with your mention about we don't know what money is. If you just were to redefine money In other words, the dollar bills that we have in our pockets or whatever currency you may think of, even if it's just basic papers, say the only way that you or I can get hold of money is by producing something which is of social value, either bake bread or build a car or build an airplane or render some service. You're a doctor, you're an accountant. And the only way that any individual or corporation can actually get hold of money is by giving something productive back to the whole, to all of society, most problems would just go away because there would be no entropy. In other words, the basic idea behind money is that it cannot grow in a parasitical manner. The whole banking system, not just with usury and interest, but even with fractional banking, is based on the idea that certain organizations and certain individuals running those organizations are able to get tons of money, and I mean really tons of money, producing no productive work at all. Actually, they are the parasites that live off your work and my work, because people who live off, usury and the whole banking system, that money is coming out of somewhere, and what people don't realize that somewhere is your pocket and my pocket. We all earn less and make less money than we should because there is somebody somewhere through a very complex and anonymous system that is stealing, is literally stealing what is rightfully ours. Now, the only way that they can do it is that they built in complexity into the system so that you don't understand it and 99% of the people won't see it. This is artificial complexity, which is a way of hiding it. It's a way of drawing a curtain or making a smoke screen so that we don't see it. It's basically camouflage. So we have to break through this camouflage that the system uses and generates purposely in order to cover their footprints. And I think that what we're starting now to see is a lot of people are whistleblowers saying, hey, here are the footprints.
Mm-hmm. Now you understand why I call my show Evident Footprints.
Absolutely.
In conjunction with what you just stated, I would like to add that, and you sort of touched on this without really identifying it, but I want to add the English language and the dichotomous manner in which it was constructed. The words mean the opposite of how they're constructed to create phrases or other words. And I sometimes use the example of the word apart, APART.
Yeah.
Apart means to be separated or a distance from, disconnected. And when you take the two syllables and divide it into the two words that make up that word, A and part, and separate them, now the meaning is the opposite. It means belonging to.
Yeah, a part of, right.
Yeah, right? Okay. Exactly. So by dividing the word, you bring the meaning together, and by putting the word, the two words together, you divide the meaning. The meaning is the opposite. And they do this with laws. They do this with regulations. And it's word games is all it is.
Well, yeah. And, you know, the whilst I make a very great differentiation between a man's or a woman's personality on the one hand and his soul on the other, which are two very different things. And if anything, the mystery of life is to try and bring as much of the soul into your personality, into your consciousness. But this whole civilization, which is very US-based, let's face it, is very left-brain. And the left brain naturally works with words and with concepts and so forth. And as you say, anybody who controls the words that we use is controlling the ideas that we think and even the way we go around certain problems. You touched upon, and I'm very glad you do, because I think we one of the worst things that anybody can do is self-censorship. You touched upon the problem of Zionism, which is a problem, and it's a very complex one and has to be addressed. But, for example, I've addressed it down here in my country. It's brought me a lot of trouble because I was accused of being a virulent anti-Semite by two of the major Zionist organizations down here, because in 2006 I had the nerve of criticizing Israel for the genocide they did when they invaded southern Lebanon. Now, look at how words work, whether it's in English or in Spanish. If I criticize Israel or anything that a Jew does, I'm automatically branded an anti-Semite, which is a word with a lot of emotion, with a lot of power, with a lot of punch, if nobody wants to be called an anti-Semite in any part of the world. However, if a Jew attacks me, there's no word to describe it. So anybody criticizing Israel or something done by the Jewish community is automatically an anti-Semite. But if the Jewish community attacks the Catholic Church or attacks a Protestant church or attacks Argentina or says the worst things that anybody can imagine about anybody, like, for example, calling me a virulent anti-Semite, which I am not, well, but there is simply no word to describe what they are doing. So the fact that you use words almost as pieces of artillery, as weapons of war, and a lot of people don't realize that. That when you open the newspaper or you listen to the radio or TV, a lot of concepts where they want to show us this guy's good, that guy's bad, this is good, this is bad, you should be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that, a lot of it is based on the semantic use of words as weapons.
Well, if I went so far as to go backwards from Zionism and said that it ended in Wall Street, and it goes to England, and it goes to Germany, and it goes to Turkey, and it goes to Egypt, and it goes to Mongolia, and it ends up beginning in Tibet as the Bon. I can draw the lines and connect the dots from the Bon of Tibet to the Mon of Mongolia, and that connects with the pharaohs of Egypt via Montauk in New York on Long Island.
Yes.
The connections are there.
Absolutely.
The mystic they're connections.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And the implication that Zionism is the same as Judaism is absolutely false.
Well, you know, you really put in a lot of that because I'm also very interested in studying the original Bon culture or even religion in Tibet, and Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Jung has touched upon that.
Yes.
In a series of very interesting books. But when you mention Zionism, as an Argentinian citizen, I am particularly concerned, and I think your listeners will be able to understand why. First of all, as you well said, one thing is the Jewish people, another thing is the Jewish religion, which goes back 3,000 or 3,200 years, however you want to measure it, maybe 3,500 years. I think, Don, that anybody in the 21st century who will discriminate another person on account of his religion has got to be completely off his rocker. I mean, especially the Jewish religion, which is not even militant, because you might say, well, look, you know, there are certain Christians that are, they will knock on your door on Sunday and they want to save you, and they're very evangelical, and they might even get a bit militant and even a bit aggressive. But the Jews are never out to convert anybody. So it is a very, very quiet religion that doesn't seek to convince anybody or to convert anybody to Judaism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's be very clear that the Jewish people, the Jewish religion, we don't have a problem with. However,
absolutely not. And to say that one is anti-Semitic because they can differentiate between a Semite and an Ashkenazi.
Right.
You see, those are two different things. Let's speak the truth about those realities.
Exactly. Now, Zionism is a political ideology which, okay, has a couple of centuries it's deeply rooted, but formally it was, let's say, it was shaped into its present form by Leon Pinsker from Russia. I think he came from Odessa. And very particularly by the Viennese lawyer Theodor Herzl. Now, Theodor Herzl, that was back in the late 19th century. In 1896, he wrote a book which is considered to be the founding essay or founding book for modern Zionism, which is called The Jewish State. In the Jewish state, he goes through the need, he describes the need for the Jewish people from, especially from Europe, to come together, to have a homeland and so forth. And he said, the ideal thing would be to have it in the Holy Land, in Palestine. However, the Sultan of Turkey at that time, that was part of the Ottoman Empire, he probably won't be able to be giving this to us. We actually tried and he said no. So there's a whole chapter which is called by Theodor Herzl in his book, Palestine or Argentine, because he said the second option would be to found the Jewish state in Argentina. And he literally says, Argentina, we're talking in, think of this, he's writing in 1896. Argentina, which has a vast territory, a very low population, immense wealth in just about anything you can imagine, would have a great interest in giving us part of their territory, and we would compensate them financially. Now, let's fast forward 110 years. When we had our banking collapse and financial collapse and economic collapse in 2001, in August 2002, the New York Times published an article saying that the secession of Patagonia, which is the southern part of Argentina, would be a way for Argentina to pay its foreign debt. That what Argentina should do is allow Patagonia to secede, which is already very, very heavily occupied by Jewish interests, by the way, and that would be a way of paying for our foreign debt. Now, that didn't happen. But if it comes in the pages of the New York Times, you can bet that they are preparing the Argentinian psyche and the global psyche that maybe one day Patagonia will secede from the rest of the country, and that a new country will be set up there. And I personally believe that that new country will be the new Judea or the new Israel or whatever you want to call it, because the state of Israel, having shot itself in the foot and become a completely unviable state, they know that whilst Israel is a military garrison, they have to set up, slowly but surely, an alternative state where they can send their elderly, their peace-loving people and so forth in Israel and have them migrate into southern Argentina, which is why they are buying extensive tracts of land. You have Israeli agents going through the entire Patagonia, both on the Argentinian and the Chilean side. And you have guys like Joseph Lewis from England and Ted Turner and Douglas Tompkins and Benetton and a whole host of interests. People buying up a huge tracts of Patagonia.
Now, you referenced Argentina returning to colonialism, in a sense.
Yeah.
Under what power?
Well, in a way, you see, there are two ways. there are two ways you can control a country. You can either invade it outright, like happens in Iraq, or as is happening in Afghanistan, or historically the way the Germans invaded France and so forth. But invasions are very, very unpopular, and they end up being impossible to maintain. The Germans found out about that with France and with the Resistance, and the Israelis are finding out with the Palestinians. So the second best way to run a country is to say, okay, let's put in a lot of money, let's identify those people, those locals, who are willing to sell not just their country, they're willing to sell their mother, their children, whatever, for money, for social prestige, for personal well-being. We can finance their political parties, let's finance their campaigns, let's use our media so that they are always shown in the best light. Anybody having a politically incorrect opinion will be automatically blackballed, and we won't let those people go on TV, radio, the press, and so forth. And all we have to do is just put some money on this group, which is a bit to the right of center, put some money on this other group, which is a bit to the left of center, have them alternate in power, and we always have people governing the country in the executive branch, in the legislative branch, and so forth, who will always do our bidding. All we need to do is just invest the right amounts of money in the right people at the right time, and then we can run the show. What I usually say when I give I do a lot of conferencing here in Argentina is I say, look, let's redefine our president, which right now happens to be a woman, Cristina Kirchner, who is the wife of the former president. That's the sort of democracy we have down here. Let's redefine Mrs. Kirchner, not as the president of Argentina, but as the CEO, the chief executive officer of Argentina. And that clarifies a lot of things. And I think you can do this with Obama, too, by the way, and with George Bush. Because if we redefine the president as the CEO, that automatically leads us to ask two key questions. If Obama or Kirchner are the CEOs of the United States and of Argentina, well, then who sits on the board of directors of the United States and of Argentina? And above that, who are the shareholders of the United States and of Argentina, who are the people really owning the country? So in a way, when I say colonialism, I say in the sense that our nation state has been eroded. We used to have a sovereign nation state many years back, but it has slowly but surely eroded into just being a colonial administration where we have a president, which is basically a CEO who reports to not a colonial power. In the 19th century, it was easier. We were a colony of Spain. You guys in the 18th century were a colony of Britain. It was very direct. You could say, where's the enemy? In London. It was very clear. Nowadays, we are all colonies of a global supranational private infrastructure or superstructure that controls us all, but we can't quite see it and we can't quite put our finger on it unless you really start delving very deep and start understanding what the Council on Foreign Relations are, what the Trilateral Commission is, what Freemasonry is, what the Vatican is. I didn't say the Catholic Church. I mean the Vatican as a political institution and what the Bilderbergers are.
And a few more secret societies. That
yes, we can, the list is long.
Yes. I was. You answered that very eloquently. I was more alluding to, you know, can you identify a country? But that's probably a stupid expectation on my part because it's multinational. Because it's that geopolitical movement that we identified a little while ago related to the banking system.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but I could say, for example, from the point of view of Argentina, and to be consistent to what we've been saying, and if I were to give you, okay, throughout our history, we used to be a colony of Spain, and we quote-unquote declared ourselves independent of Spain when Spain was invaded by Napoleon. So there was nothing really very heroic about that. I have much greater respect for the American Revolution because you guys declared yourself independent of what at that time was the premier global superpower, Britain. Now, we declared ourselves independent of Spain, but the price of that, because by then, this is 1810 and 1816, by then, British Freemasonry was very powerful. You know, the Brits tried to invade Buenos Aires twice, in 1806 and 1807, and we threw them out. And the Navy commander, a guy by the name of William Beresford, he was actually tried in Britain, and he was severely punished. And Parliament, the British Parliament in 1808, decided that we should not try to control the former Spanish or the present Spanish colonies through invasion. We should try to control them through economic means. And that they have done splendidly. So Argentina stopped being a formal Spanish colony to become a virtual British colony. And after the Second World War, that was inherited by the United States. In a way, America inherited many chunks of the British colonial empire, not formally, but through economic means. So in a way, the countries which have had the worst influence upon Argentina have been Britain for the greater part of our history, and I hate to say this, but the United States ever after the Second World War. We had a president here. He made a lot of mistakes, but at least he had his geopolitics very clear in mind. Juan Perón, Evita's husband,
yes.
Just so everybody will know who he did a lot of things wrong, and a lot of people don't like his style. I didn't like his style either, but we have to think that the guy came to power in 1945, and he was ousted in 1955. It was a totally different world, but he had it very clear in his mind that Argentina's main enemies were Britain after the war, and I hate to say this, the United States. So he said, okay, we're going to try and build a strong country, a strong nucleus, which would have been Argentina, for a future South American country. He ended up being ousted. He was actually in talks with the Brazilian president and the Chilean president at that time in 1952, 53, to bring all these three countries together to become the nucleus of a South American nation, but all three presidents were ousted. So, you know.
Now the Nazis at the end of World War II, it's well known, it's been documented that many of the people who were war criminals found their way to Argentina. But and we were lied to in our history books, and a lot of my research is based upon this, what I'm going to say now. We were infiltrated not just by scientists who went to NASA and certain research foundations, but by the whole spy network, the Abwehr, the SS.
Yes.
Underground, yeah. Okay? And very specifically, I can tell you that Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, who ran the Abwehr, in Dachau, they were known as the Dachau DVD, the Deutsche Verteidigungsdienst,
yeah.
Went to Oklahoma and set up shop at Oklahoma Baptist University as a law professor under the name of Samuel Randall Pittman.
Mm-hmm.
He lived on, I believe it's Midland Avenue. His rent was paid for by the CIA.
This is Admiral Canaris, or
yes,
okay.
And Circuit Chautauqua, which was a traveling, you could almost call it a traveling circus in a way, because it was entertainment, but it was social engineering, and it was of a Germanic flavor, we'll say. I found names like John Foster Dulles as one of the participants in that.
Yeah.
Randolph Churchill was in the list. Okay, so you can see that this German-British connection was being infiltrated. They were infiltrating the country and putting their network of people. What was America experiencing? Immigration. They had people coming over by the boatloads every couple of days. They were arriving at Ellis Island, being sent to places like Kansas, Iowa, Oklahoma, Texas. And this ramped up later on. When you have a chance to read my research, you'll see this reflected.
Yeah, yeah.
But in particular, we know that Hitler went to Argentina, and we know that Otto Skorzeny went to Argentina. Now, Hitler's pilot, and for the moment her name escapes me,
Hannah Reich.
Hannah Reich, yes. Skorzeny described how Hitler was taken to Austria. He was flown to Austria, and then he was flown to Spain. Now, we have the Madrid Circular, which was released or discovered in 1950. Germany plots with the Kremlin. This whole thing that we're experiencing here in the States began in earnest in 1950. So you could say when the OSS became the CIA in 1947, that's when they implemented this plan. Reinhard Gehlen was basically the interface between the United States and Germany and Russia. And the gold that they stole, the loot that they stole, and I'm speaking about the Nazis, went through Spain with the assistance of Spain and the Vatican. Eva Perón gave $100 million to Otto Skorzeny. And George H.W. Bush, whose real name is George H. Scherf Jr., actually stole that money from Skorzeny. That money had been bequeathed to Otto Skorzeny to do something good with it. Now, what that means, I don't know. But it seemed to me that, in a sense, Eva was trusted more than Juan was.
Yes, first of all, I think we have to, in a way, be cautious because when you go into this whole field, there is, at least as far as I know, it's very difficult to get proof going. However, it is a fact of life that when the Second World War ended, Argentina was one of the favorite spots where the former National Socialist Nazi leadership actually went. Just for the benefit of your listeners, when Germany was finally defeated on and signed their capitulation on 8th of May 1945, mm-hmm. on 17th October of that same year, Juan Perón, actually, a popular revolution brings Juan Perón into power because he had been jailed because he by the military government that he was part of, and he was sent off, carted off to an island off Buenos Aires. And when the masses heard that this guy who had given them a lot of social benefits and so forth had been jailed by the government, they literally walked straight into the central square in Buenos Aires, Plaza de Mayo, and they asked for the government to bring him back, which they did. And then he went out on the balcony and gave one of his famous speeches in that balcony that became so famous with Evita and so forth. And he was finally, there were elections, and he was finally voted officially into power, very democratically, in February 1940. Now, what did Perón do? He was very nationalist. He was married to a splendid woman, Evita, and so forth. And because he was exiled later in Spain, and he's actually said this literally in a whole series of interviews. He said, well, we were confronted with the Second World War that was over. A lot of German scientists were going to the United States. A lot of other German scientists were going into the Soviet Union. They were using German technology to benefit the U.S. and to benefit Russia. So I tried to do the same thing. And he said, I brought in guys like, for example, Otto Skorzeny, Adolf Galland, Hans Ulrich Rudel, and Kurt Tank. Kurt Tank actually designed Latin America's first jet fighter plane. If you look at the Sabre F-86, the MiG-19 and a plane down here called the Pulki, it's basically the same design of the Messerschmitt Me-219. Mm-hmm. So what you had was Perón being very shrewd and saying, well, if you're going to take your scientists to America and you other guys to the Soviet Union, we're going to do the same. And a lot of these guys definitely did come here. The safe haven channel was very much through the Vatican and through Franco's Spain. Francisco Franco was in power in Spain. And Eva was very much, she was actually a very trusted friend of a guy by the name of, I forget his first name, but his last name was Freud. Freund. And, you know, he brought in a lot of the money, and he was a German businessman for many, many years down here in Argentina. And about what I don't know, and I know there's a lot of rumors, I remember when I was brought up in New York as a kid in the 1960s, it was very popular to go around with little buttons on your lapels. And one of them said, Hitler is alive and doing well in Argentina. There's always been, even back in the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of a myth about that. But there's a point that you might want to investigate, and I can later send you a lot of detail on this. There is a place in Argentina called La Falda, which is a beautiful mountain resort in the mountains of Córdoba. Córdoba is a very central province.
Hitler used to ski there.
Right. It's a beautiful area, and there's a very old hotel that you can visit now just as a museum. It finally became a municipal museum called the Eden Hotel. And the family who ran it, by the name of Einhorn, the Einhorn family, they helped the National Socialists reach power. And they have the original of a letter signed by Hitler to these people saying, we want to thank you for your splendid financial cooperation, which came right in the nick of time. I can say that had you not helped us, we probably would have never reached power. We never would have been able to reach power in January of 1933, I think it was. So in a way, they themselves said, and the FBI investigated this after the war, there were rumors, and there's actually a document from the FBI saying that they had prepared already from way before the end of the war a safe haven for Hitler and other people. If they wanted to come to Argentina, they could find a safe place in Córdoba, Argentina, which is very central and it's very mountainous and it's rather rugged, so it would have been ideal. So, yes, there might be something to that. Anyway, it doesn't matter because by now he would have been 120 years old, so there's nothing much that he can do to found a Fourth Reich. But there definitely is, a hidden history behind all of this. And Germany, which officially capitulated, actually Germany never capitulated. The armed forces of Germany capitulated. Admiral Dönitz in May 1945. There's a lot of things that happened after that that history will just completely black out. But a lot more stuff happened, and I even think that a lot more stuff is even happening to this very day.
Well, my research shows that Hitler spent about 30 years at Lake McDonald Lodge in the Glacier National Park.
Mm-hmm.
and he died in Clinton, Maryland in 2004. I've said this on some other shows. And I can connect the dots. Now, what's interesting, too, is, and we know the aliases of one Dr. George Mengele.
Yep.
Not George, Joseph. They're all
Joseph
Mengele, they're all named George except for him.
Right. This is it.
Who goes by Dr. Green, Dr. Greenbaum, and has used many other aliases. And normally, if you track certain mass murders or serial killings in certain areas of the country, and I'm speaking about the United States, the method or the MO is basically very similar. And law enforcement agencies are told to lay off that, you know, it's a high priority not to investigate those murders. The Zodiac Killer, instance, of San Francisco is one. Now we have a multiplicity of people coming forth who were part of the MK Ultra mind control program or the, this presidential, model is the term they use for the sex slaves that service presidents and certain politicians. They all recall seeing both individuals together, even having received certain mind control training through those individuals.
Yeah.
So it's, you could say, well, it's a rumor they're putting out there just for disinformation, but it's uncanny what people have described. not knowing each other and describing similar stories. Plus, we have many photographs which would support this. So,
yeah, there is a hidden parallel side to all of these to official history, and it's very worthwhile that we should understand and have as clear an understanding of what really happened, because then you realize that, you see, power is always like a pyramid. I mean, power will always organize itself as a pyramid, and world power also. And you figure, okay, if you're in the middle of the pyramid and you are an American in 1943, and then there's a German in 1940 and on the other side of the pyramid, well, okay, you are obviously on different sides of the pyramid, and you figure, okay, well, we're out to kill each other, we're going to bomb each other out of existence. But as you go up the pyramid, at the very tip of the pyramid, there is no differentiation. So, you know, when you go up to the Harrimans and the Bushes and the Canaries and the Hitlers and so forth, way up there, there is probably very little distance, and you can imagine them sitting around the common table and saying, okay, how do we do this? You guys are going to lose the war, but you've got technologies that we need. You guys have a lot of information. You guys have a lot of techniques that we would like to use. If you go back to the origins of the Nazis in Germany, which had a lot to do with the intellectuals that worked around the Thule Gesellschaft, mm-hmm. The Thule Gesellschaft from Munich had connections with the Golden Dawn and the Outer, which was something founded by the Brits. It included guys like, I don't know, William Butler Yeats, and it included a whole host of luminaries. So, in a way, you figure there is really, when you get to the way at the top of the pyramid, things are very different than what the official history textbooks will have to read. Which I can understand, because, I mean, if you are governing America and you want to align your people against in favor of certain traditional allies, like, for example, Britain or Israel, and against theoretical foes, well, you have to be very simplistic. During the Second World War, it was the Japs and the Krauts. They are the enemy, and the Russians are our friends because they're our allies. But after the war, hey, no, listen, we're scratching our heads. It's the Soviets who are our friend. It's the Red Menace. We have to fight them. And now that the Red Menace disappeared, they say, okay, we need a new enemy. Who's that enemy going to be? Oh, global terrorism. Yeah, we have to have a war on terrorism. It's the fundamentalist jihad, or the fundamentalist al-Qaeda organizations. So, you know, all countries do that. They tend to simplify. And the Germans did the same thing. I mean, the Germans did absolutely the same thing. You know, I once had a discussion down here with a Jewish colleague who told me, well, you know, your vision of history is totally incorrect. And I told him, listen, how do you think official history would have been if Hitler had won the war? And he said, well, I can imagine the Brits would have been dreadful. The Jews would have been completely demonized. The communism would have thought to be a perversion of the devil. And the Germans and the Aryans would have been great. And I go, yep, you're right. And what is official history now? The Germans and the Nazis are demonized. The Israelis are considered to be the chosen people. It's the same thing, but the other flip side of the coin.
Yeah, the flip side of the same coin.
Exactly. So, you know, we in a way, one of the things that I wrote a book down here, it's in Spanish, so, you know, unless you read Spanish, but I'm hoping to have it published in English, called The World's Mastermind. It's basically an analysis on how this whole power structure works, at least during the better part of the 20th century, focused on the Council on Foreign Relations, which, by the way, is not conspirational, because that's the way they want to brush us off, because I wanted to get my facts right, and I asked the CFR back in about 10 years ago, if I could visit their library, and you know what they said? Sure, come on over. And I spent a whole week at the library of the Council on Foreign Relations on Park Avenue and 67th Street, and they treated me very nicely, and they invited me to several conferences, and they even allowed me to photocopy a lot of their stuff in their reference library completely for free. So I was able to really make sure that all the information I had or I put into that book was correct. So it's definitely not conspirational. It's just a way that they want to, you know, conspiracy theory. They're merely trying to cover their tracks. But yes, one of the things I mentioned in that book when I finally published it is we have to think with our own minds and not with the minds of the people who run the whole show. We might find that when we think with our own minds, we might even agree with them. But there are certain other points we don't agree with them. And when they try and fill you with information, or they try to get you to think something which is not right, or they try to get you to behave in a certain way, the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, why are they doing this? And when you you ask yourself, why do they want me to behave or to think or to do such and such a thing, then you realize what their power factors are. And here I come to my own professional deformation, so to speak. You start doing your strategic planning and you figure, okay, not only do I have to know what their strong points are, which I know they have trillions of dollars of money, they run all the media, they have A-bombs, they have a great military, but what are their weak points? And Don, I can tell you they have huge amounts of weak points. And every weak point we identify of this global enemy automatically becomes a strong point for we the people.
Yes, I agree with you. And that has become the nature of my research, especially, and my journalistic endeavors. Even I'd like to comment for the listening audience that this discussion we're having is basically the more recent history of what occurred to bring us to where we are today. There certainly was a plan. The world wars and even the revolutionary wars that occurred in various countries on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean and on both sides of the Panama Canal, we could say, they mirror each other in many ways. You have these strifes that are going on, and you know, I always ask this question, why can't there just exist peace? Why why is this lie that war brings peace always told to us? Why can't anyone see that is insanity? That it's a lie, that the statement has no foundation in truth. You can start and stop wars, yes, but because you stop the war doesn't mean because everything else that's going on is designed to sort of rope you in or lasso you in like a cowboy. And that's your rights, and that's your God-given rights. I take those to be the rights of all of mankind, the rights that we were born with. Yeah, there are certain traditions and certain things that you follow to live in a nation state, but we should be able to appreciate what each nation state has to offer rather than to dominate them and to overpower them and murder their people and steal their wealth and destroy their history, their real history I'm speaking about. So in the context of what we've been talking about, we can bring that, you know, sort of fast forward into what's going on today, and we can see pretty much the same false flag events that brought about World War I, World War II, are still at work today, deeply ingrained in trying to create World War III. Any comment you would like to make in that regard?
Yeah, they're working on that, and they're working on that very hard. As I listen to you talking about, you know, why can't there be peace, I'm sure that you've read, and a lot of your people who are listening to us have read, the famous, and for some people infamous, Iron Mountain Report on the convenience of peace. That goes back to 1967. They tried to write it off as a satire and so forth. When I read it, I've read it many times, it is absolutely genuine. Conclusions that they reached, supposedly this was a report ordered by former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara during the Lyndon B. Johnson years, is that the conclusion they reached in 1967 is that the worst thing that could happen to the United States would be for universal peace to be declared. And if we don't have a legitimate and believable, credible enemy, which at that time was the USSR, well, we're going to bloody have to create one. I remember when the Soviet Union fell, finally, and George Bush Sr. was president, the minister of the former Soviet Union, I can't remember the guy's name, told the American the Secretary of State, James Baker III, he told them right before they fell, he said, "We're about to do something terrible to you guys." And James Baker asked, "What?" "We're about to take away your enemy. You're going to run out of an enemy." And since then, America has been running all over the place trying to look for a credible enemy. Obviously, Panama was not a credible enemy. Grenada was not a credible enemy. Even Saddam Hussein ended up being a non-credible enemy. I remember living in Britain in the late 70s and early 80s, and they spoke of Saddam Hussein as the good guy, because at that time the bad guy was the Ayatollahs in Iran, who had taken the embassy and so forth. But the people who really armed Saddam Hussein with weapons of mass destruction, not nuclear ones, but yes, chemical ones, were the Americans and the Brits and the Germans. Let's face it, because he was the good guy at that time. But even then, Iraq is not a credible enemy until 9/11 came and all of a sudden this is a war that will last for generations. But again, they blew it, because they were able to pull off the event magnificently. I mean, you know, the two towers fell, the Pentagon was bombed, and so forth. For no good reason, it's a little hole. You look at the Pentagon and where the part that collapsed, where one of the engines of the 757 should have gone, there's an intact window, and you know people start asking a lot of questions. So that is one of their weak points. They have the resources to pull off horrendous false flag attacks like they did in London on 7th July 2005 or 9/11 and others to come. But then they don't know how to use it properly, because they put in so many lies that it just doesn't work. We had a false flag attack down here many years before. I can send you a lot of information on that. I've actually posted a video. The Jewish Mutual Association was blown up here in 1994, and to this very day, they are blaming the Iranians, and they do this based solely on alleged intelligence supplied by Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, intelligence service, and the CIA. And it is ludicrous, because although they were able to blow up the building and they put a lot of media effort into that, it is so riddled with contradictions, outright lies, that it just doesn't hold. And that I think is one of their weak points.
Well, you hit on a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of history there. I think the bringing down of the Shah of Iran was to create this militant atmosphere in the Middle East. And of course, once they finished that war I think it was an 8-year war between Iraq and Iran.
Yeah.
And the Ayatollah Khomeini was eventually replaced by one of the participants of the raid on the U.S. Embassy.
Right. Exactly.
He's the president now. And then they realized, well, we can't just have them fighting back and forth. And there was something that occurred. Saddam Hussein had discovered some artifacts, some ancient artifacts, that would have either given him tremendous power over the rest of the world or might have destroyed the world. So they had to go in there. But the cover story is the oil. While they were there, they stole at least $100 trillion from the Central Bank of Baghdad. And very little, none of that's reported in the mainstream media. Then they coaxed Saddam into invading Kuwait. You know, go ahead, take it. And then that gave them the pretext to make him be the bad guy now. Yeah. And launch this whole thing. Because if you look at wars, especially this war that's going on, and the individual we have in the White House right now, they're trying to pit the whole world against people of the Muslim faith, and then they're trying to create a race war here in the United States under the pretext that our president is an African American, and he is neither African nor American.
Right.
You read my research, you will be absolutely convinced that I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. And now, look at what's been happening in Indonesia since 2004. and it everything points there, including my research. Everything points there. So what is going on here in the United States right now is we're going through, and the media is picking this up. I've been saying this for several months. In fact, the Gulf incident is designed to foment a race war. To a lot of people, that doesn't make sense. But I'm working on a piece which basically tracks all the paperwork, all the behind-the-scenes maneuvering of stocks, put options, who was involved, what smoke screens were put up, and the truth about how deeply that well was drilled. That information was published on September 1st, 2009 by BP, and they used the figure 35,055 feet.
Yeah, that's horrendous.
Okay. The media is not even reporting half that depth. Okay. And the whole event seems just to be a total false flag event. There's a lot of special effects going on. Definitely corrupt video, but again, when you read my research, you'll see my analysis of documents and photographs of the person sitting in the White House. The person was put there, and you succinctly brought up the issue of the corporation, the state corporation. To most people, they think that we have constitutional rights, and we do as a constitutional republic, but our problem centers around the under-the-table agreements that have existed for a few hundred years with colonial Britain and the British crown. And all the money that is funneled out of this country and has been ever since this country was established. So, and allegedly achieved its independence. There are too many lies in history. But I wanted to bring up this Gulf situation because of your excellent video, The Well from Hell, and your analysis of all these events. And I think... when you read some of my research, you're going to see it fits hand in glove.
Don, that's on your website, right?
I haven't published it yet. I'm
okay.
It's a forensic piece.
I very much look forward to reading that because, as you probably saw in that video that I posted on the Gulf incident, the Well from Hell, the very first thing I say, both in the English version and the Spanish version, is I'm not a geologist, I'm not a petroleum engineer, so what I say is from the layman's viewpoint. I stand corrected, and actually, several good friends have actually given me very good tips and said, hang on a minute, watch out with this, watch out with that, because what I do is I merely do the geopolitical analysis, and I lay no claim to having the technical expertise. I just sort of, try to base myself on what is in the media, what one can pick up from the media, and try and put it together and say, okay, why did this happen, and why does it have these characteristics? And I say this because one of the things that I've been insisting upon ever since Obama became president of the United States, and I put this in a video back in December 2009, which I call them the 12 triggers, is that in a way the powers that be, the global power elite, have decided that globalization has to be wrapped up. It's over. Why did they have it? Well, when we had the bipolar world after World War II and until 1989, 1990, when the Berlin Wall fell and Germany was reunified, and then in 1990 the Soviet Union went and Gorbachev was the last premier of the Soviet Union and so forth, they said, okay, we're going to go from the bipolar world to globalization. Under globalization, we cannot have two superpowers. We can only have one superpower. And they decided that the superpower that had to go was the Soviet Union. And one of the things that has not been written yet is a true history of why the Soviet Union fell, because a regime that installed itself through the murder of literally millions of their own people, Ukrainians, Russians, the kulaks, and so forth, all of a sudden up in the 1980s and said, hey, this was all one big mistake. Let's just give Central Europe their liberty. Let's be in communists. Let's become capitalists. Good night. That's the end of that. Without firing a shot. It's because above the United States and above the former Soviet Union, there is an even higher power. And that even higher power told the Soviet nomenklatura, guys, it's over. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book, Between Two Ages, published in 1971, which is the book that served as the ideological foundation for the Trilateral Commission together with David Rockefeller, spells it out. You have to read between the lines, but it's all there like 19 years before. And in came globalization. And what was globalization there for? To set up the electronic control infrastructure for the entire planet, to let cell phones develop, iPhones develop, 500-channel TV, cable TV develop, personal computers develop, the Internet to develop, so that we would have a literally global electronic infrastructure. What's happening now, and this is the tragedy of the United States of America, they've decided to wrap up globalization to start ushering in a world government. And in the transition going from globalization to world government, the other superpower called the United States of America has got to go, because a global government cannot take the liberty or take the risk of having a sovereign nation state that is powerful like America, because today it's been in friendly hands, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas. But what would happen if tomorrow a real American patriot were to sit in the White House and were to say, I've had it with the Federal Reserve, I've had it with the oil companies, I've had it with Goldman Sachs, I've had it with the New York Times, we're going to do things differently, and if anybody doesn't like it, they can come and tell me what to do. That would be very dangerous. So they need to split up the United States into small. It's not going to be wiped off the map, just like the Soviet Union wasn't wiped off the map. It merely stopped being what it used to be. America is going to stop being what it used to be. And I think that Barack Obama is geared to be America's Gorbachev. He will be the last president of these United States. And in a way, the Gulf incident has a lot of similarities with the Chernobyl incident, which started the process four years before the Soviet Union fell. It was back in 1986. It started the process that ended with the demise of the former Soviet Union. Well, I think this Gulf event will have a lot of similarities with that, and I insist Barack Obama will probably be the last president of these United States. We will have other United States, but it won't be what it is now.
Yeah, I think you very well may be right. I think the element that is trying to control this thing, though, is the organized crime element, which is basically stealing money from government programs, from the public programs, privatizing it, they call it.
Yeah.
Putting and taking it to foreign countries and building everything up there to increase their profit margins. You know, when they say, well, we have Homeland Security to protect our borders, and they have open borders, doesn't anyone see the dialectical argument that's going on there just in that statement?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Or they talk about ecology and green environment and sustainable communities and sustainable energy and sustainable everything. And while they do that, they're destroying the ecology by putting toxins into the ocean, killing the fish and the ecosystems. It's only criminals that act that way. What else can you call them?
They put you in a contradictory double bind. You know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because they force your mind to think with two completely contradictory statements, which sound logical, but they're contradictory. Which, you know, it goes back to what you were saying at the beginning. We need to help all our people start to think again. Think in the sense of the process. If I were to say to you, Don, what's a square circle? It sounds logical. I mean, the phrase is logical. Please tell me what a square circle is. And since it sounds logical, you can spend the rest of your life trying to figure out, well, what is a square circle, until somebody comes and taps you on the back and says, Don, the whole phrase is meaningless. It's contradictory. Don't even work on it. There is no square circle.
Well, I had a response for you, actually. It's a circular square turned inside out.
Okay. exactly. No, I just, perhaps it wasn't the best example, but in a way, we have to.
I'm thinking outside the box. That's the point.
Yeah, I know. You do that is very good. Like for example, when you put all these things together, we have to think very holistically. And sorry if I run sort of back and forth in the things we discussed during the show.
No, it's
but
fine.
For example, the bankers have, and the Zionists have, put their eye on southern Patagonia. Now, we learn, for example, here Patagonia, just to give you an example, the southern part of Argentina and of Chile as a region is called Patagonia. It's beautiful, it has mountains, it has oil, it has everything you can imagine, potable water, grazing land. It's really almost a reserve for all of humanity. And we have a lot of Israelis and Americans and Brits all of a sudden very, very concerned about the ecology. And one of these companies is called the Conservancy Foundation. They have their head office in Bariloche, which is one of our major cities down south, which is the gateway to Patagonia, beautiful tourist city and so forth. And what they are very concerned about, and they say so in their website, are the Argentinian grasslands. Now, who was the CEO of the Conservancy Foundation? Henry Paulson. Now, what the hell can Henry Paulson, former Secretary of the Treasury and former CEO of Goldman Sachs, give a damn about Argentinian grasslands?
They're doing the same thing here, only they call it the Western Reserve Land Conservancy.
It sounds so nice.
What they're doing, they're using that land for derivatives and hedge funds.
Yeah.
That's all they're doing. And if they can steal it in the process, they do it. So those are the homes and certain business properties go through what are called mortgage pass-through accounts. And there are two types of those. they call them MERS, actually, MERS. And right. I was going to say that's exactly what Goldman Sachs is doing, and you mentioned Paulson.
Yeah.
Paulson ran that program here in the United States until he took over his position as the Secretary of the Treasury. But he was still pulling strings there, I guarantee you. And this is going on all over the states. It's even going on in the area where I live. It's highly corrupt. Highly corrupt. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
No. But these, it's all these ideas, and you've made a hell of a good point there, because and I think that is what people like you and me can probably really bring to the table. We are so used to thinking with a silo mentality. We're talking about finance, don't even talk about the economy. Now we're talking about the economy, don't talk about politics. We're talking about American politics, don't talk about Europe. And which is okay if you want to specialize, and very often you have to be disciplined and you have to focus on a specific point. But if you focus too much, you lose the big picture. So all of a sudden, the fact that you have these ecological or pseudo-ecological organizations and NGOs in southern Argentina, but you also have them in America, and you have them, you know, like the World Wildlife Foundation and Greenpeace were so surprisingly quiet about the Gulf disaster and so forth. And, you know, we have to think holistically how all these pieces fit in. Otherwise, if you don't know what the big picture is like, you'll never understand what the basic problem is. In a way, Don, it's like if you and I were to run into a savage tribe on a deserted island, and we realize that one of the guys there, he's pretty shrewd, he's pretty intelligent, and we try to explain to him what a car is. And the guy has no idea, but you start, since you're an engineer, you start explaining to him the intricacies of a carburetor. and you just explain all the details of a carburetor, maybe the guy who's a very intelligent primitive might end up understanding, okay, I get the idea, I get the concept, but what is it used for? What's it for? Because if you don't explain to him what a car is, he will never understand how a carburetor or a steering wheel or a gearbox will actually fit into the model. So it's very often much better to start saying, well, look, a car is basically a chassis, four wheels, an engine, a gearbox, a steering system, a seat, windshield, and you can use it to move forward. Okay, how does it work? Okay, if you want to know how it works, that takes a bit more time. I'll start explaining to the engine, the carburetor, and so forth. So nowadays, when we go to school, when we go to college, and when we watch the television, when we read the newspapers, they will tell us a lot of detail about certain things, but they will never give us the big picture. And what we have to do, in a way, is have the big picture, which I think is what I can tell you're doing, and which is what I'm trying to do. It's like, you know, when we were kids, remember, we would put together jigsaw puzzles. When you put together a jigsaw puzzle, if all of a sudden you form the front part of a ship, well, you know that the empty space behind that is not going to be a barn. It's going to be the back part of a ship. So you have to look for that. It, you know, even if you don't have all the pieces, you start having an idea of what the whole picture would look like. And you can infer a lot of the information. You don't need to have 100% of the details. With 60% of the jigsaw puzzle, your mind holistically can have a pretty good idea of what the whole will look like. So if it's a boat with trees, well, don't look for a skyscraper, because it's just not going to be part of that picture.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Wow. what comes to mind is the system, and I have pointed this out to my readers and my listening audience time and again, and they would tell you the same thing, that society is basically controlled through a system of illusions, which they call beliefs. We are under the thumb of a belief system. Everybody is assuming that what they know, what they experience, is real because of what they're told. And this is accomplished subconsciously through symbology, and both subconsciously and consciously through images.
Yeah.
And you could take it a step further and make it religious in a sense, or more universal, and say idol worship. Everything is based on idol worship, and this incessant need to compete, to be better than someone else, to have more than they do, or to be more acclaimed, more famous than they are. And we just don't see, as a people, we don't see that when they make these gigantic movie screens that they're making these things bigger than life, and we view these people as bigger than life, when in reality, many of them are smaller than us when you see them
right.
In person.
So, absolutely.
So we put these false values on everything from, accomplishment, or they call it success. Everyone has to pursue success. That makes us good hivers, doesn't it? Makes us good little gold miners. So
Exactly.
Just wanted to make that comment on the basis of what you were describing, because that is a method that's used. And all these electronic devices and all these things that everybody is supposed to have to be in vogue with the rest of society are designed to control us even more.
Yeah. And in a way, we are in a way walking, as W. Somerset Maugham used to say in one of his books, we're literally walking on the razor's edge, because whilst if we want to fight the system, we need to use a lot of these contraptions. Right now, I mean, we're speaking on your radio program. I'm sitting here with my laptop. I've got to have it. If I didn't have this contraption, well, you and I would either not be talking, or we would be running a huge telephone bill for a long-distance international call. So in a way, the important thing is to understand it. When you understand what these guys are after, when you understand how you control this, when you understand all the things that they do to make us behave in a certain way, I think in a way it acts like a vaccine. from that moment onwards, you can even move in there. You can move down, I don't know, Chicago or New York or Buenos Aires. You can use your cell phone. You can use your laptop. Actually, we must use them because we're using it to combat them, because the instruments themselves are in themselves neither good nor bad. Like television, it's neither good nor bad. It's just there. It's the content that counts. And I think that people are increasingly awakening to the fact that what we need to do is put genuine content and get all the BS out of everything that's being fed to us, and it will span things not just political and economic and definitely financial, and it spans not only in going back to what we were saying before in understanding what money is, but it also will span something like the arts. What is music, for example? I'm a hell of a music fan, and a lot of the stuff that is being plugged like music, you can tell it's merely rhythm, which is used to induce hypnotic states in people's minds collectively, so that they will be more open to persuasion, whether it be publicity or a political campaign or a message that they want to instill into your brain. So, mm-hmm. You know, all these things we have to. Understanding is the best protection against being captured by these schemes and these systems.
Well, it's all frequency control. It's like the bell in the school, the bell on top of the church, the siren on the police car or on a fire engine, the stop sign, the street light, the clocks.
Right.
And the music is being used in that way. It's a frequency control. Certain pulses are designed to get us marching to a certain beat, and many are chaotic. They break up. Even I could go into a whole metaphysical explanation as to what's going on, but you could say they interfere with our DNA structures and our nervous systems and our thought processes and our higher sensitivities that go beyond the five they teach us in school.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I definitely agree with you on that. You probably read about the A4, the standard A musical note at 440 hertz.
Yes, I've done cycles. Much writing on that. Yes.
Okay. I'm due to be on the Leonard Horowitz show sometime next week, because he invited me to talk about. He's one of the guys I understand that actually studied this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm correct there. I didn't know about him until last week when his producer contacted me. But I think that, you know, that is also one of the many points. And again, you find the Rockefeller Foundation funding the standard 440 hertz A note.
Yes.
Which has, in a way, distorted the basic musical annotation. Verdi, Mozart, and Wagner, their A note was at 432 cycles. My wife plays the violin in a symphony orchestra here in Buenos Aires, and I can tell them they're permanently fighting, you know, so trying to adjust their pitch and their tuning. And she herself was telling me, we either go below 440 or above 440. She had my piano here at home attuned the other day to 443 because it fits in better with a quartet she's trying to run. But 440 is very arbitrary, and it just doesn't seem to work properly. And it does generate other frequencies which are negative and which have an impact on DNA, as you were saying. You know?
Yes. 417 or 528 might be two frequencies to tune. But if you're tuning certain instruments like a piano, it's difficult to tune lower-priced instruments to that frequency.
Yeah, they won't hold. It won't hold the pitch.
And still, those frequencies, and there are basically nine, are all harmonics of even a more pure tone. And that's a whole topic for another show. But I see the 440, the international tuning standard, which is ingrained now into all digital instruments as well as the original acoustic instruments. They can vary slightly, slightly lower or slightly above, but the instruments don't perform well when they're tuned so far out. Now, in respect to what the 440 frequency does, it's very structured. You have the number 44 hidden in that 440, and you have 4 times 11. And then the 4 plus 4 makes an 8, and 8 is associated with money and materialism. So it creates a materialistic consciousness and subconsciousness, which does affect the body. And the mind as well.
We are all vibration, are we not?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I've been composing music for 20 years using these principles. That's what I did originally.
Okay, that's very good. Yeah. Okay. Music is a good gateway to understanding these things because it really opens the mind, and it opens the mind without the visual. Mm-hmm. Which is very good, very often. Of all the arts, it's the only one that really, the only means that it needs to reach you is the air, separating you from the instruments. And, and music needs to be sequential in time. I mean, you can see a picture as a whole, you can see a statue as a whole, you can see a cathedral as a whole, you might have to walk around it. But music, you have to literally listen to the entire sequence. And there's a mystery to that, because if you're going to listen to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you might know it all by heart, note by note, but you need a full hour and a half to be able to actually listen to the whole thing in its proper sequence and at its proper speed and with all the dynamics and all the harmony and all the melody built into it.
Mm-hmm. Music, like sculpting, is three-dimensional, but in another sense, it even goes beyond that. It moves into other dimensions, and its ability to heal, its ability to communicate with the rest of the universe. Literally, a well-written musical composition and a well-performed musical composition can put you in touch with the center of the universe.
Right. Well, I'm very glad you said that, because one of the most terrible controlling factors, especially on the younger people, on young folks, they've destroyed the inherent musical sensitivity of man. I mean, it's one thing to be born and to live following good music. I mean, music that comes from the soul and that should be a spirit opener, so to speak. And it's another thing to listen to this prefabricated electronic noise, which often is really basically just a lot of noise with very little or no sentiment built into it. And, that in a way forms. I have to be very honest with you, Don. I believe, and I told that to my wife and my kids, that whatever I am, whether it's good or bad, but I am me to a great extent, thanks to the eye-opening and spirit-opening experience of Bach, of Beethoven, of Wagner, of Puccini. And if I had never run across these guys, I'm sure I would be something different. Maybe better, maybe worse, but I definitely wouldn't be me. Because in a way, music is what brings the soul together with the personality, and you try, bring the self, as Jung would say, and try and develop something which is different. It's even a magnetic center that I think, to a great extent, music brings forth, which is probably what will survive us after death.
Mm-hmm. And like Mozart and Tchaikovsky and Chopin, yep, and Debussy, all of those composers came here to raise the vibration, the frequency of this planet.
Yes,
and,
sir.
And man's consciousness. And you're merely describing that occurred within your being.
Exactly.
And I could say that you could ask the question, well, if you're in music, why did you become a researcher? Well, as an arranger, as a composer, as an orchestrator, I learned how to connect the dots on the music. It's just connecting different dots, that's all.
Exactly. That's a good metaphor. I never thought of it that way. You're quite right.
Well, I wish you the best on your interview with Dr. Horowitz. He did some work with Dr. Joe Paleo also.
Right.
Who originally made the connection with the sacred frequencies from his studies of the Bible and the sacred writings, and as well as the Holy Grail and even Da Vinci's studies, because Da Vinci knew about this as well. And he was probably the one that delivered it to us in more modern times. But this is something that's been there for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
We were steered away from it intentionally.
Yeah. You know, if you ever want to discuss one specific point, because you just mentioned one of my favorite subjects, the Grail, which is a very, very profound thing. You know that Wagner composed his last opera around the Grail mystery, Parsifal.
Mm-hmm.
And I made an interpretation, I think is a proper word, that in a way there are two of Wagner's works which are prophetic, even are part of an initiation, and I'm not sure that he realized it fully himself. And one of them is the Ring of the Nibelungs, which is a cycle with four operas. Rheingold, the Valkyrie, Siegfried, and the Twilight of the Gods, which can be interpreted as the present cycle folding and closing. In other words, the Golden Age, Rheingold, the Bronze Age, the Silver Age, rather, with the Valkyrie, the Bronze Age with Siegfried, and the Iron Age, as Ovid used to call it, the worst and most decadent of the base metal iron, which is the present age, which is the end of the world, but not the end of the world that the planet will blow up. It's merely the end of a time cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And then in his Parsifal, I believe that he sort of opened and said, well, what's going to come up next? And he put it in a lot of symbolism, both musical and in the text, in this opera, which is the only Wagnerian opera which is open-ended. All Wagner operas always end with, you know, the hero dying and the heroine dying and this and that. Like, they close dramatically. But Parsifal is merely, he left it open. He premiered it in July of 1882, and the guy died in February of 1883. So, in a way, I think, I'm not sure Wagner was aware of that, but I think that he was used as a vehicle to put a lot of symbolism into this. And for those who are not familiar with Wagner, a lot of the stories in the music, he used this trick called the leitmotif, which are specific melodies that identify people, characters, objects, feelings, sentiments, and so forth. So a lot of the story is not in the actual text being sung, but it's in the orchestra and the way he brings all these leitmotifs together, blending them in the most incredible way, sometimes in major keys, sometimes in minor keys, sometimes inverted, sometimes just the first part, sometimes just the second part. But you can see that there's a very rich embroidery in the musical score itself that underlies the entire text. And the text is very Shakespearean in its style. So very often, you know, you find a lot of wisdom, even prophetic wisdom, in works such as, well, like you know, these two works by Wagner, and I'm sure in many other works by many other artists and writers and composers and so forth.
My goodness. Well, we can do a whole show on that. Yes, definitely in the future.
Okay.
Adrian, we're about out of time here.
Yes.
The network was gracious to give us an extra hour this evening.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay.
I want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for doing that, and Seth on the sound as well. We had a moment where we lost contact with the network, but that was an hour ago or so, and I think we might be missing 3 to 5 seconds of our conversation.
Well, not that important.
Those things happen. It happened on the network end, so we're, you know, I have no explanation other than to let our listening audience know that we are aware that occurred. I don't apologize because I don't like paying homage to the sun god Apollo.
Okay, I read you loud and clear.
But I want to thank you. It was a very interesting conversation for me. I hope it was for you as well.
Absolutely.
And I know that we touched upon many things. I think next week, as you already know, Jim Murray is going to be joining us. So we're going to have a tremendous scientist inventor.
Wonderful.
And he's a brilliant man, and he said he would be listening to your interview tonight. He was interested in hearing what you had to say.
And our best regards to him, then.
Oh, yes. He's going to be thrilled to share the mic with you, and as so will I, and I'm sure the listeners as well. Please give out any contact information. I'm currently on your website. I could give that out, or if you prefer to do that, by all means.
Yes, sure. Thanks a lot. But basically, my website is www.asalbucci. That's ASALBUCHI.com.AR. My email is arsalbucci, again, ARSALBUCHI, @gmail.com. And anybody writing to me, I'm making as great an effort as I can to answer all emails, or at least, you know, to acknowledge them and so forth. And, Don, as I say, I'm extremely thankful for this opportunity you give me of voicing these ideas and having such a truly high-level conversation with somebody who's obviously very, very widely cultured and highly cultured as yourself. And, you know, I'm at your complete disposal, and I look forward to the program next Saturday with Jim, and definitely with yourself. So, you know, I'm very thankful, and it's been a great session.
Well, equally for me, and I'm sure the listeners, and I will also bring you on the show more often too. We have the month of August coming up, so.
Thank you. Well, it'd be my pleasure.
That is wide open. Okay. It's been just an absolute delight, and I look forward to hearing anything you want to share with me. You had mentioned you had some historical information that you might be able to share with me. I look forward to that.
I'll send you an email.
And let me know if I can do anything to help you on your end. This is about networking and bringing people together. And
okay.
We're reaching across the Western Hemisphere this evening, and that's just remarkable that we can do that for 2 hours. And hopefully you have some listeners in Argentina, too.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do tune in. I know about that. You know, even though there's a language barrier, but, you know, a lot of people here speak English, or at least they understand English. So, yeah, I know a lot of people. I told them about this program, and they're listening in. So, as I say, a real pleasure, and I'm at your fullest disposal whenever you say, my friend.
Okay, very good. Well, I'll say good night, and wish you the best until we speak next Friday.
Right.
Okay, folks.
Same to you, Don. Take care.
All right, thank you. Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Tonight's special guest, Adrian Salbucci. Again, his website is www.asalbucci.com.ar. asalbucci.com.ar. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network and blogtalkradio.com. Also want to thank Seth Hendrick, Don Newsom on the sound tonight, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. True Ott. We'll probably be talking about the Gulf of Mexico, bringing out new information. I think we have a new organization now. It's called the NAABP, and we'll be talking about that group. Little joke there. In the meantime, I wish everyone a wonderful weekend, and a good night, and a night filled with peace, love, and light.